The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. Annual sponsors for the City Club are Northwest Nazarene University, Red Sky, and the Idaho Humanities Council. The moderator for today's forum is Kevin Richard.
Welcome to the 2017 Legislative Pundits Forum and Winter Carnival. I want to thank you all for braving the elements to join us, and I look forward to your questions. And again, join the conversation on Twitter, hashtag CCBOI. I'd like to start by thanking our sponsors who make these events possible. Our Pundits Forum sponsors include ACLU of Idaho, the Idaho College of Osteopathic Medicine, Group 1 Sotheby's, and WAMI Medical Education Program. I want to also thank our media sponsors, Boise State Public Radio and Peppershock Media, and our university sponsors, Boise State University and the University of Idaho. Now, I'd like you all to say hello to my little friend. Back by popular demand, it's the Snark Jar. Now, you may remember the rules from last year. For every sarcastic remark, the offending snarkmonger must put a dollar into the jar. We managed to raise $11 last year for our student programs, and I expect that we will do even better in 2017. And you know, this is actually a good segue for today's discussion. There's a piece of conventional wisdom around the State House that holds that the really tough legislative sessions are the ones that come with a lot of extra money laying around, and 2017 is one of those years. According to the latest projections, the current budget year will end with a surplus of $130.8 million. Governor Butch Otter has said his top priority is to fund education, but many lawmakers want tax relief, and the governor has said he's keeping an open mind to those ideas. And there are other big-ticket issues that remain unresolved. There is Idaho's highway maintenance backlog. It's a problem that the governor acknowledged last week but did not address in his State of the State address on Monday. And there's the predicament of Idaho's gap population, the 78,000 Idahoans who do not qualify for Medicaid and do not qualify under Idaho's health insurance exchange. Also looming over this 2017 session is the uncertainty that comes with any change in the White House. And this transition is especially difficult to handicap. How will the Trump administration address health care, infrastructure, public lands, school choice and vouchers? And will any of those decisions come during the debate that will unfold during the 2017 session? Oh, and we're 16 months away from the 2018 primaries. Not that pre-election positioning ever affects policymaking. So you put it all together, and you have a political climate that is almost as unpredictable as a president-elect's Twitter account. Yeah, okay. All right. But you know what? After what happened yesterday, that is probably the most family-friendly joke you're going to hear about Trump today. If anything, I should take 50 cents out of this jar for exercising restraint. But I won't. Now, on to our panel. We're lucky that we have a very good panel, an all-star panel that's going to help us sort out where we stand as this session begins and where we're headed. And I'm going to go from my immediate right and onward. Melissa Davlin is co-host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television. She is versatile even by today's standards of multimedia journalism. She's a former newspaper reporter, she also blogs, and she co-hosts the Point of Personal Privilege podcast. Next to her is Betsy Russell, who is the State House's blogger of record and a reporter with the Spokane Spokesman Review. Her Eye on Boise blog is a must-read and a real-time source of state government news, and she's also the longtime president of the Idaho Press Club. Next to Betsy is Jim Weatherby, a professor emeritus at Boise State University and a longtime Idaho political analyst. He is so much of a fixture in State House circles that he is the one member of our group that has inspired a parody Twitter account. Good job, Jim. Last but not least is our newcomer to the panel, Bill Spence, a veteran State House reporter who writes for the Lewiston Tribune. So I'm hoping that he will be able to give us some context beyond the slushy Boise Beltway. And I'm also hoping he'll give us some context from an extended assignment he had last year on Capitol Hill. So let's jump into questions and start where we seem to always start at the beginning of a legislative session. The tone is set by the governor in the State of the State address on Monday. We've had 2 days to kind of digest what we heard and maybe what we didn't hear. So what are the takeaways in terms of what was said and what wasn't said? Melissa, I'll start with you.
Thanks, Kevin. I'm going to answer that question in kind of a roundabout way because this is on my mind. Before I came here, I spent the morning on assignment at a felony probation and parole office across town with the rest of the Idaho Report's crew, and spent some time talking to an officer and an offender. And this offender, she's in her 60s and is a survivor of domestic abuse and sexual assault. And while Hollywood tends to romanticize tales of revenge, the justice system doesn't. And so she ended up in jail when she set her significant other's bed on fire. She has been in and out of the system since then, and it's been an up and down ride for the past several years. And she can trace her up periods to times when she was actively seeking mental health through the probation system. And I say that to give a micro-level example of kind of what Governor Otter was talking about and what the legislature will deal with, not just when it comes to mental health care for felony parolees, which is something that the governor recommended and the Department of Health and Welfare has requested, but this woman, regardless of how well she's doing, will likely cost taxpayers money for the rest of her life. She likely won't be a contributing member of society. And so at what point might we have been able to prevent that as a society? And you can't talk about things like the justice system without talking about health and welfare. You can't talk about health and welfare without talking about taxes. You can't talk about taxes without talking about the economy. And all of these things are linked together. And over the past few years, we've started seeing these bigger picture conversations about how everything is affected, how transportation is affected by the economy, and how the economy is affected by education, and how education affects the justice system. But I don't know if those conversations are happening on the same global level that they need to be happening across the legislature, across the justice system and the judiciary, and with the governor's office. And so looking at the State of the State address, we saw examples of that, and I guess moving forward, I'm wondering how much more we're going to see of these big global pictures and how everything's connected.
Thank you. Betsy.
To me, it seemed that the governor set up a real push and pull between funding education, which he said is his number one priority, and the desire among many in the legislature, particularly Republicans in the House, for tax cuts, for significant tax cuts this year. And the governor actually went so far as to issue what sounded to me like a stern warning that he would not entertain any tax cut proposals that interfered with his desire to invest in education and other essential needs. The governor's commitment to funding his five-year program for improving schools that came out of his task force recommendations, he's been very consistent about that. He's gotten all sides on board with that, and that seems to be going forward. He offered up an unemployment insurance tax cut to mollify the tax cut gods. But I think that there are still rumbles in that volcano. When I first heard this proposal, I thought perhaps it related to the announcement last month that our unemployment insurance tax for employers was already going to go down in 2017 by 6.3%. It turns out this is on top of that. It is a significant tax cut for business in Idaho. It would be $115 million over the next 3 years. Most employers would see their tax fall by 30% over that time. But is that enough to mollify those in the legislature who want broad general tax cuts? I certainly haven't gotten that impression thus far from talking with people in the legislature and legislative leaders, so I think that we're in for a fight. And, of course, I always enjoy covering a good fight.
So, Kevin, having a fake Twitter account, that is a good thing. But I want everybody to know I don't write any of those things, particularly the comments about the City Club Civility Project, which I thought was quite negative for whoever authored that particular tweet. Now, as to the governor's very short message to the legislature on Monday in combining the State of the State and the budget address into one, I'll mark that out as Weatherby's complaint number 4. I've been complaining about State of the State addresses ever since Dirk Kempthorne decided that he wanted to deliver his State of the State address on prime time and combine the two. And we've not had clarity since from any of the governors who made statements, particularly about trying to set forth their vision for this state, as well as to explain to the public how they're going to pay for it. And I think that's unfortunate. So here, yet again, one more year is a vote for splitting that up. And I can remember I made this comment a few years ago, and a chair of the Finance or Appropriations Committee, I won't tell you who, was shaking his or her head very in agreement with everything I said about that. So on we go. As far as the speech was concerned, very optimistic. And I don't want to encourage the tax, did you call them gods? Or guys?
Unless you prefer demons? Is that
demons? No. that Idaho is doing very well. You look at a lot of other states running very high deficits and really being challenged. So we are, as the governor said, financially secure. I was disappointed in the fact that there was no discussion of transportation. Now, I know this governor has had great difficulty dealing with the legislature on this issue in 2009 as well as 2015 in terms of not getting the kind of response he needed and not getting the kind of product that would address the $262 million we have in maintenance deficit. And that number is growing. And the governor rightly stated that that is deficit spending when you're not contributing to address your maintenance needs. I was also surprised that after having announced that he was going to conduct or put together a task force on higher education, that there was no comment about that or no emphasis in that in his State of the State. I think that would have been important in terms of developing momentum for an issue that is, I think, very important in this state. Often when we talk about education, we're talking about K through 12, but it's rightful that there is an increased emphasis on higher education. The governor should have given more emphasis to that in his State of the State address.
So Jim talked about transportation, and that was one of the things that stood out for me about the State of the State as well. My first session covering the legislature was the 2009 session, which is the second longest in state history, lasted 117 days. Part of that was because the legislature was waiting to find out what Congress would do as far as the stimulus package, but a major part of that session was the fight over the governor's transportation package. And at the time, his office was in the Bora building. I very distinctly remember coming into his office late in the session and seeing him take out his big red veto stamp and pound it on 25 appropriation bills to force the legislature to stay in town and to keep dealing with his demands for transportation funding. That may have been the last time I saw him very publicly try to take a hammer to the legislature and force the legislature to accede to his wishes. And it didn't work then, and that might be why I haven't seen it happen since then. I think I've more seen him trying to transition towards finding a winning subject, something where he and the legislature could go arm in arm on, and education seems to have become that issue. That was certainly the standout from this year's State of the State address. I guess two other minor issues that stood out this year, the two bright lines that that he seemed to draw. One, Betsy mentioned him mentioning that he would not entertain any fiscal options that jeopardized the basic functions of government, particularly education. The other bright line that may put him at odds with some in the legislature was saying that he is not advocating for a takeover of public lands. And last week he mentioned that he's kind of moved to that position since he started writing checks for wildfire damages and seeing how much the state pays versus how much the federal government pays. So to me, those were two interesting bright lines in the state of the state.
But I do want to start on the tax issue, the unemployment tax proposal that we've seen, and the question of whether that is going to go far enough to satisfy the tax hawks in the legislature, because this is not a tax cut that will affect everyday Idahoans. It'll affect businesses.
Well, I would urge caution without knowing much about it, but I can remember history when the unemployment tax was cut some years ago, and then we had a downturn, which created the need to increase that tax. As far as it's related to the tax hawks, some of them are ideologically have an ideological propensity to want to cut any tax they see, and want to starve the beast. So you have to recognize there is that sentiment. But there is a further sentiment among a lot of legislators, and I can't tell you how many, or we'll see how significant they are in this session, that our income tax rates are not competitive. And indeed, they are high, and they've been high for decades. I can cite legislators in the 1960s complaining about our high income tax rates. And you look at our neighboring states who either don't have an income tax or have an income tax rate that is much lower than Idaho. So the urge is, every session, to whittle down that 7.4% rate to something that is in the competitive range. Those who oppose it would say, wait a minute, Idaho's overall tax burden is very low. So we are high as far as income tax are concerned, but much lower in other elements, and you need to look at the total package.
Bill.
In 9 years, I don't think I've ever heard any legislator or, frankly, any business person, anybody outside of the legislature, say that unemployment, our unemployment insurance rate is what's holding us back economically. So I don't see the legislature looking at that and saying, yeah, that's going to address our problems. It's going to make us more competitive with other states. It's going to help us bring businesses in. It's kind of a moot point. I don't see that shaking their desire for additional tax cuts. The other impression is that the governor's budget proposal probably raised the likelihood that legislators will be demanding tax cuts, because he is growing government faster than the projected rate of economic growth. And it provides the argument that the tax cut lawmakers have been making for years, that if we don't cut taxes, we're going to start growing government faster than the economy. The only solution is to cut taxes. The governor's budget proposal fed into that argument.
At the Associated Taxpayers Conference this year, there was a speaker from the Tax Foundation who actually did point to the unemployment insurance tax rate and said that was one area where Idaho is high compared to other states. And that was a contention that the State Department of Labor hotly disputed and said they're looking at it, you know, this way, you could look at it that way, and then we're low. One thing to remember, in the last downturn when we had to raise our unemployment insurance tax rate, that wasn't the only thing we had to do. The fund went broke after we had cut the tax rate, and we had to borrow something like $200 million from the federal government to bail it out, and we had to pay all that back. So I think there is certainly, from a historical perspective, some reluctance to get ourselves back into that position. The governor said in his State of the State message that this tax cut would still maintain the fund in a sound manner. I'd like to hear more information about that. I think that, you know, given our experience, it's a touchy subject. One other thing. Our estimated surplus of up to $130 million, that is one-time money. That's a amount of cash projected to be left over at the end of the year. We do have experience in this state with granting ongoing permanent income tax funds by drawing on one-time money. Governor Kempthorne did it. He didn't want to. He wanted a one-time tax refund, but the legislature wanted ongoing cuts. He went along, and boom, 2 years later, we had to raise the state sales tax. So there are all kinds of calculations and things that need to be weighed as lawmakers decide just how far they want to go on tax cuts this year.
A quick follow-up to Betsy's comments. And it goes to those legislators who say how hard it is to legislate during a session with a surplus. Ask former Speaker Bruce Newcomb, who I think is in the audience, about that question. And those who served in the 2003 legislature who were forced to raise taxes to protect education services.
It's worth noting on the tax issue, the Boise Metro Chamber of Commerce came out with its legislative priorities on Tuesday. Two of them were reduce the corporate tax rate, corporate income tax rate, and continue funding education. So that kind of moves us into a question about education, and it ties into a question from the audience. We talked about the K-12 budget proposal. The biggest piece of the new money is $58 million for teacher salaries under the career ladder. But there's been a lot of consternation and a lot of concern about the evaluations process. Will the evaluations snafu, in the words of a questioner, look it up, it's probably worth a buck in the snark jar. Will that snafu affect the funding for the career ladder?
I don't think it will affect the funding for the career ladder this year. I think the governor and legislative leadership have been very, very clear that, yes, the accountability piece is very important, and they are going to get the accountability portion of this sorted out. That's the process, though, that is going to be incredibly interesting moving forward over the next 3 months. Idaho Education News, Clark Corbin has done a lot of reporting on this, as have a few other outlets. And what is just as interesting as this desk report or whatever it was called, but basically the audit on the evaluations that was done before the career ladder even went into effect. More interesting than that to me was the apparent dysfunction and miscommunication between the State Board of Education, the legislature, and the State Department of Education. And I think seeing how that plays out and who steps forward to take the lead on any sort of reforms is going to be a key issue in the coming year or two. I don't think the $58 million this year is in danger, but I also don't know that the legislature is going to be willing to go any further than that.
Boy, I think the career ladder very likely will go forward, but the questions about the evaluation system, Melissa has a good point. The governor's budget proposal is to give additional money to the State Board of Education to train administrators on how to better evaluate teachers rather than to the State Department of Education. And we have seen moves like this in the past, and it doesn't, I guess, seem to matter if the superintendent is a Republican or a Democrat. We sometimes see friction between the board and the superintendent and the legislature and the governor. And they have to have an evaluation system in place that they can trust if they're going to impose a new teacher pay system where teachers are paid more based on good evaluations. That's obvious. And I do expect them to work it out. I think that in some ways the snafu, as it was referred to with the evaluations, gives legislators something to fight about with regard to the career ladder, even if in the end they are simply going to approve the $58 million. And then they can say, look, we came to agreement. We accomplished something. $58 million for the career ladder, and we'll be done.
Never mind that it was promised 3 years ago. We are going to clear that bar. We're gonna make it happen.
Which is $2 for that one. Particularly since
now we got runaway spending going on here.
Particularly
the career ladder.
Who sets the rules here, Weatherby?
Particularly when it's your money this time that you're spending.
That's two.
I floated her alone last time she went so deep in.
I still owe you from last year.
Absolutely, in
Sorry.
Many ways.
Okay, watch the crosstalk. Don't go on this.
Just one positive Let's note not, here but, among some of the discord we're having. I think the legislature is to be complimented to continue funding the career ladder. It's rare sometimes when an elected body goes through an election that maintains that commitment, and it appears that they're going to do that. And obviously, that's very needed. You talk about Ed News. There was a story this summer about the teacher shortage, or one administrator called a teacher famine, where particularly in rural areas, it's not only difficult to get math teachers and special ed teachers, it's difficult to get PE and U.S. history teachers as well. We are definitely faced with a crisis here, and this funding for the career ladder is very important. Does that mean that we are directly competitive with all other states? But it would mean that we're in the beginning stages of trying to catch up. This is indeed very important, and hopefully we'll go forward even after a little fight over the accountability feature, which I'm sure is very important to the conservatives. Last year, I believe the votes for education were almost unanimous as far as the appropriation measures were concerned, which was an extraordinary achievement.
The only thing I have to add is, as a North Idaho reporter, who watches both Washington and Idaho, the Washington legislature would love to be having a fight over $58 million, because right now they're having a fight over whether they need to fund an additional $2 billion or $7 billion for public schools. So $58 billion, they'd love to have that debate.
Just as an aside, something I found rather interesting about the governor's proposal on the accountability on the evaluations framework, he's talking about training for superintendents to make sure they do evaluations more properly, with more fidelity. This is a different angle on the issue. It's, in the past, it's been an issue about the quality of the data, the accuracy of the data that's being reported. Now we're moving into discussion about whether the evaluations themselves are accurate. I'll be interested to see how that kind of plays itself out. For our radio audience, I want to remind you that you are listening to the City Club of Boise's annual Legislative Pundits Forum. We are joined by Melissa Davlin, Betsy Russell, Jim Weatherby, and Bill Spence. And I want to start with a question. I want to go back to what we talked about a little bit about higher education. We discussed the Higher Education Task Force, but the higher education budget request was only about a 2.1% increase in the higher education budget. In general fund spending, there was some funding for building projects, but as far as an actual growth in the budget, a fairly low increase relative to what other agencies and what other initiatives we're getting, including K-12. How do you reconcile those two? Big task force, big discussion about higher education, fairly Spartan budget request.
I immediately had that question when I saw the governor's budget, and I did ask his budget director, Janie Revere, and she said, well, in addition to the 2.1% increase in ongoing funds, there's a $35 million building program in university construction all across the state, and that is correct, and that is outside of the higher ed budget. But then the other part of her answer was, after we get the results of the task force, maybe then, next year, we'll be looking at more robust increases for higher education.
And it's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out, because one part that I know we'll be looking for at Idaho Reports is seeing what the task force's metrics of success are, what the goal is. So when we're talking about higher education, is the goal to get people into the workforce, or is it to get people educated? And are those two things really mutually exclusive? And so there's been a lot of talk over the past several years about getting people job ready and getting people to learn how to weld and to be ready to go on the construction site, because Idaho is a great place if you are a skilled worker. But then we have the four-year universities, and there's also the importance of reading the Republic and the Allegory of the Cave and learning how the economy works and learning how to be a good citizen. And so I'm very curious to see how much of the discussion is going to be on that, because I'm positive we can expect a lot of discussion on the VOTEC side of it and the community college side of it. But as far as how, and Bill Spence and I have talked about this, as far as how it affects the four-year universities, that's going to be really, really interesting.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, when I was talking with candidates last summer for the 2016 election, candidates, Democrats, Republicans, really, really conservative Republicans, all of them were strong supporters of additional funding for career technical education. And I think that view is very prevalent both with the governor and throughout the legislature. So to the extent that the new task force is focusing on vocational education, it can only benefit career technical. I don't think it benefits the four-year institutions. I think they face the same challenge that they've been facing throughout my time in Idaho, and that's the same challenge that the Idaho Transportation Department had a number of years ago, where there was distrust in the legislature of how the institutions are using the public tax dollars. And ITD Director Brian Ness overcame that suspicion by making a number of substantive changes in his organization and talking about those changes constantly, letting legislators know, here's how we're improving our on-the-ground service. Here's what we're doing to make sure that Highway 95 is free of snow when you're driving down here in January. He's done a superb job of that, and because of that, the legislature in 2015 overcame its antipathy to raising taxes and fees and gave him some additional money. The four-year institutions have not done that very effectively as far as showing how they're taking those public tax dollars and removing overhead and putting more money into classrooms, into student performance, and into helping Idaho students get jobs. And they're going to have the burden of proof is going to be on them to address that issue, I think, before the legislature is going to be willing to pony up a lot of extra money for those for the four-year institutions.
Is it okay if a panelist asks a question of the fellow
Sure.
panelists? And that is, we know that the 2009 cuts to public education have been restored. Have the 2009 cuts to higher education been restored, or is higher education still underwater?
Higher education, I think, was cut more than pretty much any other part of state government in our downturn. And I know that there is definitely a sense that those cuts have not been restored. There are also some measures by which people argue that public schools have not been fully restored. We saw a little bit of budget inside baseball this week that I thought provided a hint of perhaps what the governor is looking for with his higher education task force. When his budget staff was briefing JFAC, they said that next year's budget is the last in which Otter will propose funding the enrollment workload adjustment. And thereafter, funding for universities will be based on performance per the recommendations of this new task force. So I think that goes right back to what everyone on our panel has been saying about the expectations of higher ed. Furthermore, the governor has presented this as the equivalent of his K-12 task force, which really brought the stakeholders together, tried to get everybody to agree on the outcomes they want, and then there was a willingness to pony up money. If that is the case, if that is really the big picture view that is taken, I think it could be very good for higher education in Idaho at all levels.
But the big difference was the K-12 task force was also driven by political considerations, where the legislature as a whole, and Republicans in particular, had gotten black eyes from the funding cuts due to the recession and also the Student Come First Luna Law issue. They had the reputation that they were disrespecting teachers, that they were unwilling to fund public schools, and the K-12 task force was driven in part by that and helped them push back against that impression. I don't think they're getting the same black eye over not funding higher education and not providing more money for students who want to study Plato and poetry and art history.
It's weird that you don't see that same outrage.
Yeah. I actually have a philosophy degree, so I'm really ticked about it.
But. Yeah.
Those suspect philosophy majors and art historians, they can't be trusted. A bunch of questions about healthcare, and I'm going to start with you, Betsy, on this one. Questions about what happens now with the gap population. Does anything happen this year, especially in light of the change in the White House?
Well, I was rather surprised at the approach that Governor Otter took to this issue. He actually, in his State of the State address, called for kicking the can down the road, said that waiting is not always such a great thing, but it's what we need to do now with the Trump administration there. And this is not the message, of course, that we've been hearing from the Otter administration for the last 3 or 4 years. His health and welfare director, Dick Armstrong, who the governor also announced in his State of the State address is retiring in June, told me just last week that in the current situation, the gap population is not addressed. If the ACA is repealed, the gap population is still not addressed. Nothing changes, and if Idaho wants to do something with state funds to serve that population, it can do it, and it can do it right now. And that really is exactly what the Legislative Interim Task Force was talking about and looking at. They're kicking around a lot of ideas for how they can help people who are in that gap population, but the governor is really backing away. And I don't know what that means for where that goes this session. I think that the advocates who had been pushing hard for Medicaid expansion for the last 3 years, and based on the results of the governor's task forces that studied it in depth and talked about what would be good for the state and its people and its finances and its health, are kind of taken aback. I did expect something to happen this session with regard to the gap population, and I think that it could still, but it will be incremental and it will be state-funded.
Melissa?
So I think what we're going to see over the next year is this conversation about the gap population completely transforming, because regardless of what happens with the incoming Trump administration, that population is going to change, whether how we measure the gap, regardless of how many people are in there. And there's been a lot of discussion as to the 78,000 number, whether or not that's accurate and whether that's stable. But that's not going to matter in a few months, because one way or another, the Affordable Care Act is going to change. So the conversation is going to turn into this more global discussion about indigent health care. And Idaho is going to have a great opportunity, depending on how you look at it. Because for years now, Idahoans have heard the legislature say, well, we want to address this, but we're trying to work within the parameters of the Affordable Care Act, which we don't like. Well, you're not going to have that anymore. And so now the ball's in your court. And lawmakers have been saying this whole time, we want to do something to help the indigent population. We want to do something to help the counties that are so often socked with that burden of paying for indigent health care. So, and I know that you meant it when you said it. You weren't just paying lip service to Idahoans. So now's your opportunity. And now you get to do it. And now you get to create this Idaho solution. And I think a lot of people are going to be really interested to see what that looks like.
To me, this was coming into the session, this was the biggest question mark, whether the legislature is going to do anything to address the gap population, particularly with the uncertainty about what's going to happen in Congress and with the Affordable Care Act. I think the only thing that can be said with absolute certainty is that every reporter in the State House is hoping they do something, because the irony of them waiting until Donald Trump is elected president to expand Medicaid is just too good to pass up. So,
Betsy, I would remind you the governor said that was a big can that he was kicking down the road.
Does that make it better?
No, it doesn't make it better. It doesn't make it better, too, when there was it an interim committee or just a working group that met this summer and unanimously said that doing nothing was not an option. And now doing nothing is probable, is what you're saying.
Well, I think what the interim group, and you know, we have interim committees, but rather than formal interim committees, we also have task forces and working groups, and this was some shade of that. But what the group said is that we absolutely must do something. They just didn't decide what. But that was viewed actually as a really significant accomplishment.
and missing and missing from the field are some champions of addressing the gap population, Drs. Ruschi and Schmidt, and now Dick Armstrong retiring.
I think some of the proposals you're going to see are going to be familiar. I think I've heard that there is a proposal similar to PCAP that is going to be coming forward. I think you might, speaking of the surplus that the budget office has been talking about, people might want to be keeping an eye on that CAT fund, which has diminished over the past several years. But while the federal government and the states come up with a solution, in the meantime, the state might need to be looking at that CAT fund once again, at least in the transition period. I feel like we owe a dollar for Spence, at least $1. I'm going to go ahead and pony that up for you, buddy.
Is there interest on that?
No. Now, are we even? Are we even?
Oh,
now?
No. I was a lot more snarky last year.
So a question from the audience about whether any social cultural issues may be addressed by this year's legislature. I know of one that has an ever so remote chance of getting national play if it gets any traction. And you know, the legislature never gets national media attention. But there's one that has a remote possibility of getting some legs. Bill Spence, I'll start with you. There's one that... Yeah,
I'm wondering why you're starting with me, Kevin, just because I wrote a story today about one of our North Central Idaho legislator who
it's called leading the witness, Bill. Come on, play on. You're there.
I missed that. Sorry.
No, yeah, I'm just kind of leading you along here, leading
right,
the witness.
Thank you.
Come on.
So he's planning on introducing legislation that would treat abortion as first-degree murder for both the mother and for the doctor performing the abortion, except in cases where the mother's life is endangered. I have always enjoyed my conversations with this particular legislator. He's very sincere. He's also very clear on his values and what he believes the people of his district support. So. We'll see where that one goes.
I've never heard the category social cultural before, but social issues, sure. There will be not only the legislation you're talking about, Bill, but is there not an initiative, I don't know where it's going to go, that's circulating around northern Idaho.
It does almost the same thing.
Do almost the same thing, circulating in defiance of Roe v. Wade. And what are people looking forward to? To the Trump appointments to the Supreme Court. One appointment isn't going to tip the scales that much, probably. You remember the Roberts Court upheld the ACA, but there are waiting in the wings some more potential vacancies under the Trump administration, the possibilities of more conservative justices that might look at a reversal of Roe v. Wade. That would be a radical decision by a court that tends to honor precedent. But will there be social issues? Absolutely. Not only anti-abortion, but other issues as well. So Senator Sitaway, who has left the Senate Local Government Committee, jumping from the frying pan into the fire, perhaps, as chair of Senate State Affairs Committee.
And just to add, Kevin, talking with the Senate Minority Leader Michelle Stennett about this abortion bill, she made the point that with the results of the election last year, the old boundaries of what you would think of as, you know, this is possible and outside of these boundaries isn't likely, those boundaries have gotten very blurred with the outcome of this election. So we may be seeing a number of bills this session, and they may have chances this year that they would not have had in the past.
I want to add with that petition that's circling around, it actually goes further than the proposed legislation because it has no exceptions for incest or rape. And the petition, not the legislation?
No, the legislation doesn't have
exceptions
for rape or for incest.
Oh,
the petition does.
Yeah, the petition has no exceptions, and it also goes further to outlaw certain kinds of contraceptives like IUDs and implants and emergency contraception. And, you know, those types of contraception are, you know, the fastest growing kind of contraception among women in America and globally. And so all of this, I think proponents of this know this will end up in court. I know that ACLU Idaho and ACLU Nationwide are keeping an eye on these issues. And, you know, post-Trump election, donations to the ACLU have gone up, I think, more than ever in history. And so this might be a pretty expensive battle for the state if that does, in fact, pass.
But remember, Melissa, the legislature in the wake of the defeat of the Luna laws has made it virtually impossible for citizens to get an initiative on the ballot,
and,
whether it's from
right.
the right wing or the left wing.
But if the legislation passes,
right? Yes,
yeah.
Well, both the governor and the Republican leadership in the legislature have made it very clear that they want a short legislative session this year. And really hot debates about hot-button social issues and far-reaching proposals that likely will end up in court are not conducive to a short legislative session. So it may be that the legislative leaders have their hands full to corral those who really want to press social issues this year if they want to get out of town.
But when has a leadership ever said they didn't want a short session?
Melissa, I want to start this question with you on the faith healing issue, the status of where we are on the faith healing issue.
If you're not familiar with it, Idaho is one of the few states that has an exemption for medical neglect. Medically negligent homicide is, I think, the full term. So basically what it means is if you believe, you don't believe in medicine and you believe that you can pray to heal an illness, and as a result a child in your care passes away, you cannot be charged with manslaughter or homicide. Idaho is one of the few states. This has come up increasingly the past few legislative sessions. I've been looking at it for a few years now. I no story politically has kept me up more at night, and I'm not a crier. This story has brought me to tears a few times. It is really, really, really tough. We have talked to people on all sides of this issue, and it's not just two sides. It's not just faith healers against the world. It is very, very complex, and there are a lot of people who have complicated emotions on it. Ultimately, over the summer, there was a working group that looked at options, and while we might see legislation this year, I'm not sure it's going to go anywhere. Legislation isn't the only way this law can get passed, or this law can change, rather. So I think that you're going to see a very wonky discussion about it that goes beyond just get rid of the exemption. I think that if there are any hearings on it, it's going to be very, very difficult. It was very difficult over the summer. It was very emotional. And it's a tough thing to swallow in a legislature that really, really values religious freedom. And a lot of these lawmakers, quite frankly, the ones around Canyon County, these folks don't live in the shadows. Their kids go to school with lawmakers' kids. These folks aren't living off the grid in the middle of the woods. You know, they're members of the community. And I think those personal connections with the lawmakers in and around Canyon County does affect the discussion for better or for worse, and regardless of how you see it, whether they're more compassionate and understanding for the lawmakers or whether it is, I don't want to say conflict of interest, but it clouds the discussion. And so it's more complicated than just repeal the law in the eyes of these lawmakers, and I don't know that we're going to see a resolution this year.
This was another interim task force or working group or committee or whatever you call it. And in this case, at the end of these emotional hearings and information gathering on this topic, the committee simply concluded its task. It didn't take a vote. It didn't decide that we ought to do something or we ought not to do something. It was simply an abrupt end. And this has not been what interim legislative committees have done over the years. There has been criticism of these committees because sometimes they come up with extensive plans or they develop all these reports and they sit on a shelf. They don't go anywhere. That panel didn't even take that step. And I guess it shows how sensitive an issue this is for those who serve in our legislature.
You're listening to the City Club of Boise's annual Legislative Pundits Forum. We have about 12 minutes left and a bunch of questions that I do want to get to, starting with the perennial issue of public lands, which is a little bit of a different issue maybe now with the change in the White House. What do you see on the horizon on the federal lands issue? Will legislators follow the lead that Governor Otter has articulated?
I doubt it. There's a number of legislators who feel very passionately about pushing the transfer of public lands to the state. The bigger question is whether with a Donald Trump administration, whether they're likely to have sympathy at the federal level. And I think that's still one of the many big unknowns with the federal administration. But it's interesting to me how much the legislature and the governor are hoping for a change in relationship with the federal government, with the new administration, in terms of at least a partnership, even if it isn't a transfer of ownership of the land, then at least a partnership in terms of managing the lands. So I don't know that I have any speculation or insight into what's actually going to happen on this issue, but there's a lot of people in the legislature and in the governor's office who are hoping that there's going to be a different path forward than what they've seen the last 8 years.
I think it's worth noting that the Otter administration, even already prior to Donald Trump being elected president, had pressed forward under the Good Neighbor Authority to the point that the state actually sold a timber sale on federal land this year. And that program is proposed to expand. The governor has proposed more funding for it next year. And really, we have seen increasing partnership between the state and the federal land managers already. And the governor, in his State of the State message, was extremely excited about the relationship that he expects to build between the states and the federal government under a new Republican administration. I don't think that stops those who, as Bill described, are very passionate in the legislature from, again, passing resolutions saying we want to take over federal lands. But what actually happens on the ground is more likely to be what's accomplished through initiatives like those that the Otter administration is putting forward.
My understanding is that is one area where Clinton and Trump agreed during the campaign that public land should remain public. And you may remember Donald Trump Jr. was here in Idaho making exactly the same point. So it's quite an interesting approach. Kathy McMorris Rodgers was considered for Secretary of the Interior and all but appointed to that position. And I guess they read back through some of her questionnaire responses, and maybe she gave the wrong response on the public lands issue, and she was no longer a candidate for Secretary of the Interior. So this is a president apparently who is willing to go against Republican conservative orthodoxy, at least generally on the public lands issue.
But Jim, I'm fascinated that you are placing faith in something that Donald Trump said months ago and thinking it still applies.
He's a fellow tweeter. It was a tweet.
Thank you, Betsy.
Give me all your money.
but in all seriousness, are there issues that this presidency emboldens conservative legislators to take on? I mean, if it's not public lands, and it may not be public lands, are there issues where the conservatives are going to be emboldened?
Oh, absolutely.
You're going to see that on healthcare. You're going to see that on states' rights. I think it's going to be interesting to see whether moving forward people are cautious because, I mean, Republicans elected a wild card to the White House. I don't know if you've noticed. A little bit unpredictable. That's just straight analysis. That's not snark. And so...
It's such a blurry line, people, isn't it?
I said it with a straight face, so it's true. But I think a lot of people, a lot of conservatives see a lot of opportunity. You're going to see some bold moves, not just from Idaho, but from the states in general, knowing that things may end up in court, whether it goes, you know, back to abortion rights, health care, all sorts of issues, federal land, education, you know, ditching Common
Regulatory
Core.
Issues.
Oh, right, yeah, and that's going to be huge, especially with the EPA and contentious issues that have come up with water and pollutant discharge and everything in the past few years. But in some cases, I think states are going to be pretty cautious, too, moving forward.
Kevin, to some extent, I mean, we all know there's a portion of the legislature that was willing to advocate for some of these issues with Barack Obama in office. And so they're certainly going to be more enthusiastic about that with Donald Trump. To me, the bigger question is whether the legislature sees a opening towards practical changes in the relationship with the federal government. House Speaker Bedke was talking about, you know, what happens if they throw the keys in our laps on health care. You know, how do we get ready for that? To me, that's going to be one of the interesting things to watch for in the session is how do they try to predict which areas there might be opportunities in, and how do they prepare for them? There's certainly the desire, but until you see Congress acting, can you really prepare for movement forward with that uncertainty?
It will be interesting to see whether Miles' Law applies to the Trump administration in the long run. You know, you've heard of Rufus Miles. He developed this rule, or did I say law? I can't remember. Rule, law, Miles' Law, where you stand is dependent on where you sit. It's one thing to be a mayor railing against the state government and then being elected to state office and putting down the locals and railing against the federal government. We'll see as this change comes to Washington and people take all of these federal positions, if their changes might affect the way they deal with the states, and that the partnership may not be as happy as they think it is going in.
So I we accept debit cards too, you know, by the way. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask a question about where we're headed in the 2018 elections, and I feel like this question is probably predicated in some snark itself, so I'm ready. We have two gubernatorial candidates on the Republican field already announced, and we expect more. We have a governor who has publicly positioned for a position in the Trump administration. Whether that happens or not right now doesn't seem likely, but he's put himself out as a willing candidate for a cabinet post. You put all of this together, at what point in this game does it become more about politics in the next election cycle, and at what stage in this process does the sitting governor become something of an afterthought?
I think it's absolutely going to affect everything this session and next session, because you not only have, you know, the lieutenant governor who's actively, you know, been very open that he wants to be the next governor. And just yesterday he posted a criticism, the first attack I've really seen him make against a Democrat lawmaker about minority leader Matt Erpelding's position on public lands and the Good Neighbor Authority. That might color interactions between the minority and the lieutenant governor, who has a very good reputation for working well with everybody. You also have a state senator who has already thrown his hat in the ring for lieutenant governor, Marv Hagedorn. That might affect his dealings with other senators who might also have their eye on the same position. And so We're just in perpetual election hell. We can never get out of it. This is purgatory.
And we're perpetual election nirvana, where we have plenty to write about.
Just hold off for a little bit, guys. Any more election announcements, please?
Well, that said, I don't think the governor's an afterthought yet. I mean, he's still got to sign or veto every bill that this legislature passes. He's still proposing the budget and approving what comes out. And they've got a job to do, both this year and next year. And if the governor doesn't leave to join the Trump administration, he will still be a factor, and he still is.
Election hell. I don't understand that at all. It's not a snark. It's
a contradiction in terms.
Yeah, absolutely.
You've had very different experiences with
elections. I'm looking forward. The most interesting election this year was the 2018 gubernatorial election. I don't remember a time when we've had candidates announced so early and get confused as to which election cycle they're in. But now at least they're in the right on point to move forward to May of 2018. We have the openings now here for governor, I assume. Mm-hmm. Now, if Governor Otter doesn't get any one of these federal appointments and doesn't want to retire, we've had already one reporter speculate that he might run for re-election. I don't know whether that's a possibility or not, or if he could work that out with his wife. Lieutenant governor's position open. The potential of First District Congress position open. The treasurer's position, delicious. Be interesting to watch to see what happens and what develops. And this moving toward the completion of his term does diminish Governor Otter's influence, short-term, long-term. But as we know, and Betsy indicated, he still has his formal powers, can still play a significant role in the process, even up and through the 2018 legislative session.
I hate to disagree with my fellow pundits, but I spent 3 months back in Washington, D.C.
early
last year, and when it comes to perpetual election hell, Idaho has nothing on Congress. So
we're wrapping up. One very quick last question. We've talked about a lot of issues, but probably a lot of issues that we expect to see at the legislature. If you had to name one issue that we're not talking about yet that could emerge as the session goes on and could become a minor to major hang-up to adjournment, do you have any nominees?
Starting to hear discussion in the legislature, starting on the House side, actually, about extending Highway 16 to the interstate and creating a new exchange there. Using some previously approved Garvey capacity to pay for some of these improvements, some building bonds authority, moving from leasing state offices to building to save some money over the course of a while. Bonding and Garvey hasn't always been super popular among all lawmakers, but because it's starting on the House side, or has been being talked about on the House side, which typically sometimes has a little bit more of a problem with that, it might be less of an issue than it could have been in previous years. So I think that's going to be really interesting.
I think ethics could be an issue. All of the legislators are going through ethics training today. Idaho doesn't have any independent ethics commission or inspector general or even a hotline for anonymous complaints about corruption or waste in government. And a state agency is currently being sued for abusing its subpoena power to root out and identify and fire a whistleblower.
What? I don't know.
That's why we have you on this panel, Jim.
Let's just step out a little bit and say, how about a call for an Article 5, a call for a constitutional convention, which would be intriguing, would it not? Or Fish and Game has been involved in a lot of controversy. There are two Fish and Game commissioner appointments coming up. There's a possibility of the legislature dealing or not dealing with the Fish and Game Commission or department's request for a fee increase. That could be held hostage to yet again, and it's been, what, 12 years since there had been a fee increase, could be held hostage to moving in a different direction toward a big game tag auction.
I think it'll be interesting to watch the Democrats this session, particularly if there's a close split on the Republican side between those looking for tax relief and those looking for other uses of the surplus. Whether the Democrats find a way to be a factor in that decision and get some of their concerns heard. The other thing, I don't think it'll lengthen the session, but if this weather lasts one more week, you're going to see a resolution in favor of global warming. So.
I thought you were going to say a resolution in favor of moving the Capitol to the banana belt in Lewiston.
That's a great idea. Carolyn, Troy, I see you out there. Get that one ready.
We'll leave it at that. I want to thank our panel, and please help me thank our panel. Thank you all for being here, and walk safe, drive safe. Be careful out there. Thanks.
You've been listening to the City Club of Boise, a nonpartisan forum discussing important issues of the day in a civil manner. The next event from the City Club is a lunch forum featuring Idaho's state epidemiologist Christine Hahn on Thursday, January 26th. Find on-demand audio of this and other forums, learn about becoming a member, and see a schedule of upcoming events at cityclubofboise.org. Connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.